In 1642, the next year, the Swedes march even further south into Saxony. They again defeated the hapless Saxon army, which seems to have underperformed consistently in this part of the war. And the Swedes then advanced through Silesia into the Habsburg province of Moravia. They briefly threatened the imperial capital at Vienna and then finally pulled back to Saxony, but not before destroying the main imperial field army at the Second Battle of Breitenfeld in November of 1642, and then capturing the city of Leipzig in Saxony. Now, these campaigns are a little complicated to kind of follow blow by blow, but I think there are three important broader features when we move aside from the battle by battle and season by season aspect of it, which give us a sense of what it all means, what these campaigns between 1638 and 1642 mean for the big picture. The first key feature of them, it seems to me, is that they indicate how much the initiative has shifted in this war, away from the Habsburgs and toward their enemies. Because after all, whereas in 1636 and in 1637, the Habsburgs had been pressing their enemies, the Swedes, you know, clinging to the Baltic coast, and the French worrying about what's going to happen to Parisian suburbs, by the early 1640s, the picture has completely changed. The Habsburgs are by now reduced to chasing after French and Swedish armies, ravaging the heart of the empire, and indeed the Habsburg patrimonial lands themselves. Second of all, this is the second key feature of these campaigns, is that although they may be interesting from a tactical point of view, from a military point of view, they're fairly indecisive. It is true that there are some fairly stunning French and Swedish successes, especially the capture of the fortress of Breisach on the Rhine in 1638 and the Swedish victory at Breitenfeld in 1642. But in the big picture, I think we have to say that none of these victories is really decisive, because in no case were the Habsburgs ever forced to kind of throw in the towel and say, okay, we've lost this battle, we've lost this fortress, now we're going to sue for terms. Moreover, there's a sense in which if we look at the range of operation of the Franco-Swedish armies on the map, it's a bit deceptive, because the fact that the French and the Swedes could run all over the empire doesn't indicate simply the strength of their own alliance. It also reflects, it seems to me, the absolute exhaustion of the empire. The repeated devastations of the countryside now meant that sources of supply were pretty few and far between, and thus, after even only a relatively minor military setback, the losers would have to fall much further back than would have been necessary in the 1620s. It seems to me there's a sense in which the empire has become somewhat more porous, if you will, and everybody can move through it rather more easily than had been the case before, above all because of the enormous human cost and the devastation of the war up to this point. The third point about these campaigns is that although they were militarily indecisive, they don't force the Habsburgs to negotiate, from a political point of view, they are a complete disaster for the emperor. Because you need to see that ultimately, the Holy Roman Emperor could only stay in the war as long as he could keep most of the German princes on his side. And by 1640, the support of the German princes for their emperor was beginning to waver. The German princes found themselves just simply unwilling to put up with repeated devastations of their territories. And by the early 1640s, the German princes therefore begin putting out separate peace initiatives. They're looking to form separate peaces with the French or the Swedes and abandon the emperor. Now, the emperor himself, Ferdinand III, is aware of these peace feelers going out. These are dangerous warning signals. And he's astute enough to realize that he can't ignore what's going on. And so therefore, in the fall of 1640, Ferdinand III convoked what was the first full meeting of the Imperial Diet, the representative assembly of the entire empire, since the year 1613. It had been 27 years. And Ferdinand convened the Diet in order to try and establish some kind of a general peace. He was, by 1640, willing to make fairly substantial concessions. The emperor still insisted that the so-called normative date for the ownership of ecclesiastical property and the toleration of religious minorities was going to be frozen at January 1st, 1627. That is to say, the Habsburgs wanted to retain everything that they had acquired between the beginning of the war and January 1627. But by now, the Edict of Restitution, that extremely controversial and problematic declaration of 1629, the Edict of Restitution was now no longer going to be suspended, as the Peace of Prague had agreed, but simply abolished outright. And in fact, it's interesting that when the envoy of the papacy, the papal envoy of the Diet, heard about this, he protested formally. He didn't want any surrenders to be made at the expense of the Roman Catholic religion. And yet, despite the formal protest of the Pope, the emperor just ignores him altogether. And in a sense, the emperor has to ignore what the Pope is saying, because the emperor himself is losing the war. In March of 1641, the Elector of Brandenburg, one of the most important Protestant princes in northern Germany, signed a separate ceasefire with Sweden. The reason was, as I've said before, the elector was just not prepared to see his territory repeatedly devastated and destroyed by a foreign power simply because the elector was allied to an emperor who could not protect him.